Support for the World's Podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Nearly 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses, with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out. Things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews are all part of running your own business. And these are precisely the kinds of costly hurdles that can take time away from growing your business. That's why LegalZoom created their business legal plan. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Friends with foreign policy benefits, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump wraps up a three-day visit to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Japan.
Trump really takes this personal relationship with Abe, actually quite genuinely, as a friendship.
So what's Abe looking for in this friendship? Also, Italy's Matteo Salvini celebrates a big win in European elections with a special selfie.
And in the background, you can see a Make America Great Again baseball cap,
right,
a picture of Vladimir Putin, and a picture of Jesus all together on the shelf.
Plus, on the auction block in Mexico, luxury cars confiscated from drug lords go to the highest bidder. Proceeds go to charity. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day. In Europe today, voters have had their say. Far-right leaders there are celebrating big gains in the European Parliament. Here's Italy's Matteo Salvini speaking after the vote.
Today's vote means that the rules in Europe will change, not only for the decisions of the Italians, but also for the decisions of the French, the English, for the Hungarians, the Poles, the Finns, the Swedes, the Danish, and so a new Europe is born.
But it wasn't quite the far-right surge some were predicting either. Here's how our own Orla Barry in London puts it.
There are some clear winners and some very clear losers across the EU. As you mentioned, Salvini has been celebrating. Marine Le Pen in France from the far-right party has also been celebrating. And in terms of trends, we're seeing the kind of the national centre-left and centre-right parties, which have dominated the EU for, well, as long as anyone cares to remember. They do appear to have lost their majorities for the first time in the European Parliament, in the EU. And each country, Marco, each country has returned its own very different results on the basis of different issues. In Italy, it was immigration. In Germany, it was climate change. Here in the UK, it was Brexit.
That B word again.
That B word.
Yeah, so what does this all say about the strength of the far right across Europe? You said Matteo Salvini in Italy and Marine Le Pen in France, their parties did pretty well. But I mean, does that represent a wave across Europe?
I think it's unfair to say it's the kind of wave that we had been told about. So last week we spoke about the Netherlands. The wave didn't happen in the Netherlands. In Spain, we see that the Vox party didn't do as well as it was expected. But there are some successes. France, as you point out, Italy did very well. In Poland and Hungary, they equally, the ruling populist parties did very well. And I guess that's less surprising because in Hungary, you do have a country where the media is very much state controlled.
So that's the far right. But the Green parties around Europe are also celebrating. How did they do?
Absolutely. They did extremely well in Germany, for example, in Ireland and in the Netherlands. For Germany, the Green Party there managed to attract a huge number of younger voters. And for younger voters, climate change has really been an issue. And the young people who were able to vote then really managed to make a change at the polls.
You're in London, Orla, in the UK, and for a country that wasn't theoretically even supposed to be having an EU election, there seemed to be a lot of jubilation with the gains by the pro-Brexit party. But what did these election results for the EU even mean in London?
Well, they mean 24 hours of humiliation for the Conservatives and equally for the Labour Party as well. It's been a disastrous election for the Conservative Party. And what it says in many ways is that it was a protest vote, as we said it would be. People came out who wanted Brexit and wanted to see the UK leaving the EU, and they threw their hat in the ring with Nigel Farage. going forward, it most probably means that the contest for the Tory leadership, the next Prime Minister, is very much going to be who can take on Nigel Farage, who can take on the Brexit Party, because this morning Nigel Farage is out saying, you know, our next road is the general election, and can you beat me on that one? So the Conservatives are naturally nervous about the sort of election power and voting power that he has managed to attract.
Sounds like it's going to be a wild show for those elections in the UK. As for this EU vote, turnout was said to be the highest in 20 years, but what does that actually mean with the EU going forward?
Yes, in many ways, it is hard to see. There are naturally some very strong Eurosceptic voices in Parliament, but as we mentioned, perhaps not as strong as we thought. I think one of the key things is that the centrist parties, as we mentioned, have been weakened. But these strong Eurosceptic voices, these strong populist parties and far-right parties, while they might agree on the issue of the EU Parliament or leaving the EU or their difficulties with the EU, they don't agree on a lot of other issues. So they're not forming alliances necessarily with each other. If they were all to come together to form an alliance, which everyone says is unlikely to happen, then they would probably have some stronger voting power. In the meantime, in a sense, what it looks like is that many countries are turning back in on themselves. So we see Greece, it's already called a snap election. You know, the UK talking about their Tory party leader in Germany. What's going to happen with Merkel's coalition? Is that on rocky footing now? So all of these issues, in a sense, go back to national politics, which I guess often is the case when it comes down to EU elections. It ends up being all about national politics.
The World's Orla Barry there in London. Later this hour, what Steve Bannon has to do with the EU election results and how this weekend's voting, as Orla just mentioned, upended the Greek government. The other big story today is, of course, President Trump's visit to Japan. Some business was done in between golf and burger dinners with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Overall, the Japanese government seemed eager to keep the president entertained. I asked Yuki Tatsumi for the highlights. She's a Japan policy expert at the Stimson Center in Washington.
I think the highlight is absolutely the two leaders watching the sumo wrestling match together. And Trump giving the U.S.-Japan Friendship Cup to the winner of that tournament.
In honor of your outstanding achievement as sumo grand champion, I hereby award
you. I think that was, you know, visually, that was one highlight.
What did that suggest to you, just symbolically, that visual?
Trump really takes this personal relationship with Abe, actually quite genuinely, as a friendship.
Hey, and I just want to thank you. That was an incredible evening at sumo.
As he said in the press availability shortly after, he took the matter into his own hand.
So we did it personally. We bought that beautiful trophy, which they'll have hopefully for many hundreds of years.
He went to get that trophy personally because he realized that this is such an important occasion. These are the kind of tone that you don't normally hear out of Trump. You know, respect for the country that he's visiting. And more of a, you know, off-the-cuff, genuine way.
And I've always wanted to see sumo wrestling, so it was really great. Thank you very much for being here.
That's one. And the second is, this is on Abe's part, rolling out the red carpet for Trump, but organizing the banquet hosted by the new emperor. Trump is the first state guest since the imperial succession on May 1, and that alone carries a quite symbolic significance on Abe that he really invests a lot in making sure that his relationship with Trump is a stable and solid and friendly one.
We've heard about Shinzo Abe nominating Trump maybe for the Nobel Peace Prize, but I mean, surely Abe isn't aiming to be Trump's latest bromance. I mean, why is he putting so much work into cultivating Trump?
Their biggest concern is how U.S.-China relation goes. Increasingly, especially on the national security front, Japan faces China as increasingly militarily powerful, increasingly assertive. So it was very important for Abe to make sure that Trump always has the favorable impression of Japan.
Right in the middle of this trip, Trump tweeted that he didn't find North Korea's short-range missile tests recently disturbing. Those missiles could ostensibly hit Japan. How did that go over with Abe, and how did that affect the trip, do you think?
I think he made the strategic decision not to make too much big deal out of it. Japan was very quickly issued a statement that doesn't overly contradict what the president tweeted out, which was, while they do not necessarily consider that as the violation of the UN Security Council resolution, but it is regrettable. That's like significant tone down, kind of aligning the tone with the message that Trump tweeted out.
In any relationship with Japan and Shinzo Abe, what's in it for the U.S.?
So Japan actually has more stable relationship with other U.S. allies around the world, not just in the region. So for U.S., sometimes Japan actually does function as an important connection node.
Do you have an example of that?
Well, I mean, Trump was asked by one of the reporters during his press availability about Japan offering to perhaps mediate to tamp down the tension with Iran.
And I do believe that Iran would like to talk. And if they'd like to talk, we'd like to talk also. We'll see what happens.
But the U.S. Negotiating with Iran, with Japan as a mediator, I mean, is that just talk or is there, I mean, will that stick?
I think it could stick. And how it gets operationalized, it's too early to tell. We'll see how it rolls from here.
Yuki Tatsumi, the director of the Japan program at the Stimson Center, speaking with us from Washington. Yuki, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much.
So would you buy a car once owned by a drug dealer or a mobster knowing that you were helping poor people? That is the gamble the Mexican government made yesterday when it auctioned off more than 75 luxury cars seized from alleged drug bosses and other criminals. Reporter Frank Contreras is in Mexico City. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Marco.
What was the hot ticket item in yesterday's auction and how much did it go for?
Well, it had to be that 2007 gray-colored Lamborghini Murciélago. It went for a price of 1.47 million Mexican pesos. That translates to somewhere around $74,000. Pretty good price, really.
Yeah, that's a bargain for a Lamborghini, which makes me want to ask my curiosity question. What make of car are cartel bosses and gangsters in Mexico typically interested in, like U.S. muscle cars or trucks or foreign exotics?
They love foreign exotic. They love Porsches. But they also love American-made Corvettes. Corvettes were on the auction block, a couple of Mercedes-Benz, stylized. Some of them had armor covering, the kind that you need when you're, you know, fighting drug cartels or trying to ward off the Mexican government. A convertible Mustang was on the auction block, Ford Shelbys, and even some Volkswagens. A 1951 Volkswagen Beetle went for 253,000 Mexican pesos. That's a collector's item, as you guys know.
Yeah, right. That vintage VW Beetle that sold, would that have been manufactured in Mexico?
Absolutely. And as you know, back in the day, the Volkswagen Beetle was produced in the state of Puebla, not far from Mexico City. So it has that resonance for Mexican residents.
What's really kind of compelling about this auction is that there's a kind of Robin Hood aspect to it. Sell the valuables of the rich and give the proceeds to the poor. So how much money was raised and who does it go to?
Well, they expected to raise around $1.5 million. That's U.S. dollars. This is all brought together by the newly created Institute to Return Stolen Goods to the People, Marco. The money will be going to municipalities in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca. Poor people in Mexico live in that part of the country.
There's also something very symbolic in having this auction at the former presidential residence in Mexico City. What was the point the Mexican government was trying to make here?
Well, this is a crucial point, I think. The former residence, this is akin to the United States White House. It's called Los Pinos, and it's basically been a place of opulence for past presidents. In the minds of Mexicans, the perception has been it is the sort of headquarters for government corruption. Now, since López Obrador took office in December of last year, that location, Los Pinos, has been transformed into a museum. And it really was a sort of a symbol to the Mexican people that the past corruption of your governments is now gone.
Were you at all tempted by anything on the auction block, Frank?
I would have definitely gone for that 1951 Volkswagen sedan. Absolutely.
Yeah, that is a sweet ride. Reporter Frank Contreras speaking with us from Mexico City. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care.
You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. you'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The U.S. and Iran have had a rocky few weeks, all related to Iran's nuclear ambitions and the U.S.'s desire to keep them in check. For most of the last decade, the Iran nuclear agreement had been the means to that end. But getting to the deal in the first place was an exercise in top-secret diplomacy. If that sounds at all glamorous, Lacey Healy is here to set us straight. Healy is an expert on nuclear policy. The latest episode of her podcast, Things That Go Boom, tells the behind-the-scenes story of how the Iran nuclear deal happened and the people who got it done. Here is Lacey Healy.
There was this moment in 2012 when the U.S. and Iran almost stumbled into a war. The tension had been ratcheting up for months, and the U.S. had tried everything. Diplomacy, sanctions, sabotage, and outright threats. Meanwhile, Israel was sitting on a knife's edge, drawing literal red lines that drove home predictions that the country might launch an attack any day.
Could Israel launch an attack on Iran before the U.S. election in November, as the drums of war beat louder in Israel?
But Iran still seemed to be marching toward a bomb.
Shows that there is more installation of centrifuges in this Fordo plant.
Then, like something straight out of the movies, the Obama administration gets this offer from a mysterious fixer for the Sultan of Oman, a tiny little country in the Gulf. The Sultan's fresh off his successful negotiation to free a group of American hikers held in Iran, and he wants to set up a secret meeting. Like 007 secret. This would be a last-ditch diplomatic effort to avert a military strike on Iran. So, who do you call when you need your very own Bond?
My name is Jake Sullivan. I served in the Obama administration at both the State Department and the White House.
Then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton calls her aide Jake.
I land in Muscat, and I am met at the bottom of the stairs of the plane by an Omani in traditional Omani dress with the headscarf and the robes who puts me in a car. Okay, sorry. No.
Okay, so maybe he's not quite Bond.
I'm not a good poker player. I turn red very easily. I have the Irish Catholic guilt thing. So I'm not all that well designed for this kind of subterfuge. I arrive in Muscat in the middle of the night, having just flown in coach class, carrying my bag, trying to sleep along the way, but being a little too excited to sleep.
The meeting in Oman is so secret, Jake lets his colleagues believe he has to slip away for a family emergency.
I get there probably around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and I drive to an empty house that is the residence of a senior diplomat in the U.S. embassy in Muscat, in Oman.
Once he arrives, Jake meets with another colleague, Puneet Talwar. And this is where you get a real sense of the glamorous life of a top administration official.
Puneet takes one of the kids' bedrooms and sleeps on a kid's bed. And Puneet's over 6 feet tall, so his feet are coming off the edge of the bed. And I take the couch and sleep on the couch.
And you are not of short stature either.
No. So I guess the technical term is I curl up on the couch.
Right.
And we try to get a few hours sleep before the series of meetings that we're meant to have the next day. It was very much a question mark as to whether this was real.
When Jake wakes up the next morning, he's not 100% sure the Iranians will even show up. They've been playing a back-and-forth game of telephone for months, the White House talking to the Omanis, then the Omanis to the Iranians, who go back home, talk it over, and call up the Omanis, who get back to the White House. It's a logistical nightmare. And Jake is not a logistical nightmare kind of guy. So when the day of the meeting with the Iranians finally comes, he's on edge.
It's this kind of almost staged, managed entry, the big reveal where we both walk in through these doors and they instinctively put their hands on their chests to send the signal to us, essentially, we don't want to be rude, but we're also not here to shake your hands. So we got the message.
It's an awkward introduction. And the truth is, Jake still doesn't know exactly who these guys are.
You have the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. You have the clerics. You have the judiciary. You have the president.
So they start to talk slowly because...
Statement, interpretation.
Interpreters.
Statement, interpretation. It made it feel like we were not driving the Indy 500 at top speed. We were taking a nice lap around the track.
And eventually, Jake starts to breathe a sigh of relief.
It becomes clear fairly early on in this first session that these are serious professionals. They spoke as definitively as we did about the authority and the blessing that they had.
But it doesn't take long before that pit of anxiety in his stomach, it starts to come back.
They have expectations about what they're going to get from the United States, and they have expectations that they're not going to have to give up very much to get it.
Jake starts to realize how long this is going to take, if it's going to happen at all. And he also realizes he's going to have to break the news to Secretary Clinton.
Well, the fact is, I am very tired and frankly, very stressed. I feel like I didn't crack the code with the Iranians.
You didn't save the world in one meeting?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm thinking to myself, did we screw this up somehow? You know, did we say something wrong? Could we have made progress if we had taken a different tack?
To get back to Clinton's team, Jake has to ping pong from Muscat to Dubai, Dubai to Beijing, and Beijing to his final destination, where he gets in an SUV. He's bumping over country roads for hours.
And by the way, I'm a little bit of an unreliable narrator on this because I'm in a something of a fog as this goes on. But I see a kind of large circular structure, tented structure, and I walk in and everyone is in the middle of a Mongolian feast.
In a giant yurt. Clinton and her team are in Mongolia on part of a tour dedicated to the Obama administration's so-called pivot to Asia. And remember how Jake let his colleagues believe he had a family emergency?
They're worried about me. And so they all come up and say, are you okay? And of course I'm like, well, no, not entirely. I'm really stressed and tired. But
there you go.
But I can't share with them what's happening.
And then there's Clinton. He needs to tell her what happened with the Iranians, but he can't. Needless to say, your typical yurt isn't exactly a secure place for top secret communications.
And I catch Secretary Clinton's eye, and I speak in sort of coded, guarded language just to give her the very top line, because she's heard nothing at this point.
Clinton decides to press on. They know the chances are slim, but it's worth it. The stakes are high. Iran's nuclear program is getting scarier by the day.
If Iran actually got a nuclear weapon, that would set off an arms race across the Middle East and potentially across the world, because the Saudis and the Turks and the Egyptians and others would all feel like they should get nuclear weapons.
And hey, maybe that doesn't sound so bad. There are actually some experts who argue that the more weapons we all have, the less we'll want to lob them at each other. But then you remember, it just takes one.
It just takes one. Hear the rest of the story in Lacey Healy's podcast, Things That Go Boom, from PRI and PRX. And you can game out how you would negotiate and make decisions about nuclear weapons at nucleardecisions.org. I'm Marco Werman. Jorge Castillo was looking for a place where Mexican and American musicians could play together. Then he visited the border fence on the beach near San Diego.
And boom, I saw it right there. This is a perfect place for a fandango. We don't need documents.
How the border fandango became a reality, that story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on this Memorial Day. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Across Europe, they're figuring out what comes next after this weekend's European Parliament elections and the gains made by the nationalists there. One interested observer is Steve Bannon, President Trump's controversial former advisor and right-wing provocateur. Bannon popped up in Kazakhstan over the weekend, drawing big crowds at a gathering known as the Eurasia Media Forum.
He came to talk about global trust in politics, and it was an absolutely fascinating panel.
Natalia Antalava is the editor-in-chief of Coda Story, a nonprofit newsroom. She was at the forum in the Kazakh capital, Almaty, where a lot of attention was focused on Bannon.
At about 10 o'clock, Steve Bannon walked into the auditorium looking quite jet-lagged and red-eyed and sat on the panel with five other people, quite an eclectic mix. Steve Bannon was sharing the spotlight with a man called George Galloway, who is a former British MP who comes from far left. And it was incredible to watch these two men, political opposites, completely agree with each other throughout what was supposed to be a debate.
Right. So Steve Bannon went to this forum, kind of had his own agenda, and kind of dovetailed with the European parliamentary elections, which were on a lot of people's minds over the weekend. What was Bannon's take on far-right parties gaining seats?
Yeah, the European election absolutely dominated the conversation and Bannon's messaging. You know, Bannon announced the people of Central Asia will wake up to the news that nationalists have won in Europe.
Macron laid out in his Renaissance project the natural logical conclusion of the United States of Europe, where these nations will become basically administrative units, like states in the United States. That is being rejected by the European people. You see a rise in nationalism, and a rise in nationalism is positive. It's what unites people. It gives citizens the best level of control. And I think you're going to see a whole era of peace and prosperity start to come as we have more nationalism.
So, Natalia, how did somebody like, say, George Galloway, a far lefty person on the panel, how did he react to that?
Oh, it was a bromance in the making on that stage. He agreed with everything that Bannon said, even the idea that Europe needs more nationalism. And then I ended up witnessing quite an amazing scene after the panel because I happened to have lunch at the table next to both Galloway and Bannon. At some point at lunch, Theresa May resigned and Galloway had predicted it an hour earlier. And Steve Bannon's reaction was, oh, let me give you a hug. And they both got up, walked towards each other, embraced each other before sitting back down. So it was a different world unfolding in full display in front of you.
We often turn to you, Natalia, for your knowledge on Russia. What does Steve Bannon think of far-right leaders and parties in Europe that have a cozy relationship with Russia?
Excellent question. I did not get a straight answer to that. He will not engage with questions on Russian financing, the Russian support of his positions.
I do think that they respect what Putin has done on some of these issues, like embracing some of the more traditional values of the Judeo-Christian West. I haven't heard anybody say, I'm aligned with Russia and believe everything he does. You won't see Salvini and Le Pen, even people I think more gravitated to that, say that they're role models. I've never heard that.
That would be Matteo Salvini from Italy and Marine Le Pen in France.
That's right. I mean, complete dismissal. And I pushed him again and again. It was the only question I would say that made him pause.
Bannon is no longer a part of the Trump administration. He's had some conflict with the president. Did you get the sense that that has affected his credibility among Europeans?
There are certainly signs that it has affected his credibility with Europeans. Many of his allies in Europe, like Nigel Farage and Marine Le Pen, many of them have tried to distance themselves from him. I believe it was Marine Le Pen who described Bannon as an embarrassing friend. But he is very active in Europe. He sat down with us for about an hour and he talked quite at length about the project that he's heading in Europe. He's setting up an academy and he's taking his inspiration from none other but his nemesis, George Soros. He completely disagrees with George Soros's ideology, but he very much admires what Soros has done in terms of raising a whole generation of new leaders. So he says that's what he's dedicating himself now. I mean, it's slightly ironic. He's preaching nationalism, but he's turned into a globetrotter. We talked to his very jet-lagged press secretary who was telling us that they'd just been to Japan and they spent a lot of time in Brazil. So they're traveling constantly. And he says he's interested in kind of helping along the nationalism everywhere. Kazakhstan was very much on his radar, and Central Asia has a lot of nationalist potential.
That's Natalia Antalava, editor-in-chief of CODA Story. Thanks very much, Natalia.
Thanks, Marco.
Nationalism and national identity clearly were on the minds of some EU voters, but as we were explaining earlier this hour, many Europeans themselves are still trying to figure out what all the results will actually mean. In Greece, though, the story is pretty clear. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras and his ruling leftist party, Syriza, lost the European Parliament vote big time, so much so that Tsipras has already called for snap national elections in Greece next month. Yannis Papadopoulos is with the Katimerini newspaper. He's with us from his pretty busy newsroom in Athens. So Greeks voted in this European Parliament election, and the effect was dramatic for the country. What happened, Yannis, and what message did the results send to Greece's ruling Syriza party?
The Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, called yesterday, last night, for snap national elections because of the severe defeat in the European Parliament elections. So it looks like we're going to have national elections on June 30.
So you're saying that the defeat of Prime Minister Tsipras's party was so profound and so shook the legitimacy of the party that those snap elections, I mean, has that ever happened?
No, because this is the largest margin, the largest difference between the first and second party in the European elections that has ever been recorded in Greece.
I know Prime Minister Tsipras spoke about all this yesterday. What did he say?
Well, he said that the election result did not meet Syriza's expectations. So the electoral result does not satisfy me, Mr. Tsipras said.
Για να είναι τελικά ο ελληνικός λαός αυτός και μόνο αυτός που θα πάρει την οριστική απόφαση.
And I will not ignore it. I cannot ignore it. The final verdict is always delivered by the people, and I will not escape.
So let's get into why this happened, because Prime Minister Tsipras came to power boosted by his anger at austerity measures that were basically foisted on Greece by the EU and Germany. What happened to the public anger that was basically fuel for Tsipras and his victory? And what's been going on with austerity since Tsipras came to power?
Well, as an opposition party, Syriza had a very strong anti-austerity agenda. But when Syriza came to power, things changed. We had a long ordeal of negotiations with the EU, and we had the referendum in the summer of 2015. And then the government of Syriza had to impose cutbacks as a third bailout. So this is when things changed for the Greek public opinion as well. It would be good to mention that the Greek government tried to reverse this climate, this atmosphere, during the last few weeks. Syriza introduced tax cuts and pension payouts, but this last-minute effort to win more voters did not help Syriza.
So how big a surprise were the results for Prime Minister Tsipras himself? Because his quote was, the outcome was not up to our expectations. In political speak, that sounds to me like, wow, this really blew us away.
I believe that people in Syriza were not anticipating a result like that. They believed that the gap, the margin wouldn't be as big. They anticipated the 1 to 2 or 3% difference and not something as high as 9.4, 9.5%. So we're taken by surprise. And I don't believe that their plan was from the beginning to go to snap elections, but they had no other choice.
So, I mean, on one hand, this is a blow for Tsipras, but on the other hand, he's also warning against a return to the dark days of austerity. So is he sticking to kind of the platform that won him his loyalists in the first place?
Yes, yes, exactly. And from what I can see, Syriza will return to its anti-austerity agenda and will try again to perform as an opposition party, as it did in the past. But it seems very unlikely for them to be able to win the national elections.
Yannis Papadopoulos with the Katimerini newspaper in Athens. He's been speaking with us from his newsroom. Yannis, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's clear up one thing before our next story. Koalas are not bears. They are cuddly looking, they dwell in trees, but they are marsupials. The bear thing was just a misnomer. There have never been koala bears. Now some conservationists are worried about the day when there won't be any koalas either. A recent report from the Australian Koala Foundation calls the species functionally extinct. Even though there are 80,000 koalas in Australia, they are not breeding enough to ensure the longevity of the species. But the outlook is more nuanced than just doom. Here's zoologist Chris Draper with the Born Free Foundation in the UK.
There are certainly populations of koalas that are functionally extinct, but to say that the entire species is functionally extinct is probably stretching the situation to its, well, beyond its logical limits at the moment.
So you're saying that there is a functional extinction in Australia, but not across all koala populations?
Well, within Australia, there are numerous populations of koalas. Some are contiguous and connect with each other. Some are isolated. And I think what we're looking at is populations of koalas within Australia, some of which are becoming functionally extinct. Does that mean that the species as a whole is doomed in its current state? My understanding is not. But a lot of action will need to be taken to ensure the long-term survival of the species, given the concerns that are being raised about individual populations.
So in Australia, can you speak generally about what's causing this extinction for koalas? Like, what are the pressures on these animals?
Well, my understanding is that there's a range of pressures ranging from habitat loss, human encroachment, through to various temperature-related and water-related threats that are linked to climate change. There's also quite a high prevalence of various diseases in koalas that are certainly adding additional stress to the survival of the populations.
So what do you think are smart measures, Dr. Draper, to be taken? Because my understanding is that 80,000 koalas in Australia may seem like a lot, but not when they're having trouble breeding. So how do you make that happen?
You're right. You can't look at these things in absolute terms. You know, absolute population numbers it varies species by species as to whether or not that's a sustainable number. And I think the effort has to be put in Australia to preserve habitat, to ensure the survival of individual populations. However, nobody is saying active breeding is yet the thing to do. And
Really? That seems odd.
Well, no, because captive breeding isn't for every species. You can end up with enormous difficulties in getting animals to reproduce in captivity. You can end up with a rapid loss of behavioral and ecological competence, so that animals within a generation or two are actually, if we want to talk about functionally extinct, we talk about they're sort of functionally redundant in terms of how they would be able to survive in the wild. And koalas are just one species within ecosystems, and obviously their plight is coming to the fore. But you can guarantee that if koalas are suffering a population crash, there will be other species within that koala ecosystem that are similarly suffering. And to just treat things in isolation is going to be, I would say, a fool's errand.
Dr. Draper, koalas, of course, are only one species under threat of extinction among tens of thousands of animal and mammal species across the entire planet. How much does that picture worry you? And how do you think koalas in Australia fit into the global picture?
Enormously troubling that we're facing such a currently horrifying prospect and a horrifying future in some ways. But we're not at the end of the game. And I think we need to focus our attentions not just on symbolic, high-profile, cute, cuddly species like koalas. We need to respect the fact that these animals are not divorced from their ecosystems. I think there's an enormous role to play in terms of public awareness. And if certain crises come to the fore, like koalas, that do attract people to start looking carefully about their choices and their energy usage and their impact on the environment, then great. But we need to ensure that the conservation activities that we undertake and the conservation interventions that we undertake in the name of these animals are compassionate, sensible, and effective. And I would say that catching animals and sticking them in captivity or shipping animals across the globe to be on display in zoos is not likely to be compassionate or effective as a conservation activity.
Zoologist Chris Draper with the Born Free Foundation speaking with us from West Sussex. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Hey there, world podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in the world's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from the world. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of the world's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. If you're looking for a place to hold a big party, the U.S.-Mexico border between Tijuana and San Diego might not be at the top of your list. Not these days, anyway. And yet, right where the border barrier stretches into the Pacific Ocean, a big musical celebration is held every year, with revelers on both sides of the wall. The man behind this party is Jorge Castillo, a retired librarian living in San Diego. He's a musician, too, plays classical guitar. Reporter Clayton Kahn went to meet Castillo to find out where he got the inspiration to start a music festival at the border.
It was in 2006 that I was invited to a fandango.
El fandango. In Mexico, a fandango is a type of traditional party. It's characterized by seemingly endless hours of high-paced folk music known as son jarocho and a stomping dance called zapateado.
You know it's going to start, but nobody knows when it's going to end. It can end in 3 hours or it can end in 2 days. We don't know when to end.
That first small fandango he attended in someone's driveway in San Diego made him have an epiphany.
I remember, to me, that was the turning point. It's like, wow, I want to get involved in this, seriously. After that fandango, I think it became a form of life for me.
Thus, Jorge let his classical music collect dust and grabbed a Mexican requinto, a kind of small four-string guitar prominent in the son jarocho melodies. As soon as he would leave the library, he would be practicing son jarocho music or going to fandangos in San Diego, or in the Mexican border city of Tijuana.
Most people that play son jarocho in Tijuana don't have passport. Like out of 40 people, 50 people that play seriously son jarocho in Tijuana, maybe four have a passport to go to San Diego. So it was impossible for us to get a good fandango in San Diego with our friends from Tijuana.
It was also dangerous for those in San Diego to cross the border south into Tijuana, making it impossible to organize a joint fandango there.
Tijuana back then, it was horrible. So people were scared. So it's kind of sad that we could never get together.
That would soon change. A friend in Tijuana took Jorge to the beach, to arguably the most iconic point in the city, where the 5.5 meter tall, rusty Mexico-U.S. border fence extends out onto the sand and about 24 meters out at sea. On the U.S. side, it is an undeveloped park, kind of like a prison yard. On the Mexican side, the fence is covered with vibrant colored murals. Although Jorge grew up on the Mexico-U.S. border, he had never come to this site.
What is this? And they said, wow, this is the border and the fence and people come here and all that. And boom, I saw it right there. This is a perfect place for a fandango. We don't need documents. I mean, we can get together, finally.
By that time, it was 2007, and with the help of fellow musicians and friends, a call was put out to organize the first trans-border fandango. Jorge simply wanted all of his best friends and their best friends to play music together. To him, his friends in Tijuana were his neighbors.
In fact, there's a saying, the nicest neighborhood in Tijuana is San Diego. Es el barrio más bonito de Tijuana, San Diego.
To everyone's surprise, a lot of people showed up. All the so-called neighbors and even the friends of Jorge's best friends.
Wow, we were shocked. It was like probably 50 people on each side. Oh, it was a total success. The experience of being there with the fence in the middle, your friends on the other side, and not being able to share. I mean, like, it was sad, it was happy, it was frustrating.
That's the sound of Jorge singing at the Fandango. He is the tallest of the several dozen musicians on the U.S. side of the wall. They're huddled together facing the fence, while musicians play jarana guitars on the Mexican side of the wall.
It was so magical that I personally, and I know a lot of people experience the same thing, we forgot about the fence. We just focus on playing the music and have the party and being together.
For everyone, it was an experiment in that first year. No one, not even Border Patrol, quite knew what the rules were.
That you can probably fit almost a can of soda through the fence. Some people were passing cigarettes, were passing sodas, and people were throwing even food. And the Border Patrol, they were totally shocked, and they were saying, oh, wait, I don't think you're supposed to do that.
Jorge says they dutifully complied with all the instructions from the authorities. The border police came and said to him,
hey, Jorge, we need to stop. And then they said, can you do just one more, please? And that's it. And they said, hey, let's do La Bamba. So we started La Bamba, and they didn't know it lasted 45 minutes. La Bamba lasted 45 minutes, and they were going like, it's not over yet, it's not over yet. And they said, it's not over yet. One song? I can't believe it was one song. You guys are lying to us. No, it was one song. And that day it became official. Let's do it again next year.
And the following year, and the year after that, and for more than a decade now. However, the fence has become more difficult to permeate.
It's harder. It's harder to hear the music. It's harder to see people, but we can still do it. And we're going to keep doing it until we can.
Over the course of the decade, musicians, including Grammy Award winners, have played at this border fandango.
And we always tell people, hey, just as long as you bring your feet, you can be part of the fandango because you can dance.
Of course, many participants express their political views. But for Jorge, the gathering is fundamentally just a way to play music and be with his best friends.
It's bringing more and more people together, and it's another proof that music has no borders and music can fly. We don't care anymore about the fans. We just go, hey, it's just another fandango.
Jorge Castillo speaking there with Clayton Kahn for our partners at the BBC. The 12th annual Fandango Fronterizo is coming up later this week at the San Diego-Tijuana border. Yes, you can still make it if you plan it right. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope the last few hours of your Memorial Day are restful. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.